So you all know the outcome of the elections in the U.S. How could you miss it? I've had all kinds of people express their opinions about the election of Barack Obama and numerous emails. Emails are really rife right now. Everybody's opinions is being expressed, and the media is also expressing everybody's opinions, and so we should know everybody's opinions by now. So I'm not interested in giving opinions. But the analysis are flowing as to why Obama won and why McCain lost. I have never seen Australians so interested in an American election, or the world for that matter. I've never seen the world so interested in an election than what we saw. Now, what happened and what has happened in the past 20 years in a way that has never happened before, it is quite amazing in terms of an election. Actually, perhaps has never happened at all. I've read the reasons why the Republicans lost. There are many reasons. The Iraq War, of course, is mentioned. That's big. The latest financial crisis is what sealed the election loss. That's how it's generally explained. And that was something that wasn't quite expected. And of course, how the economy goes many times, not always, but many times, is how an election will generally go. And of course, this is all the fault of the Bush presidency. Now, he has become one of the more unpopular presidents that we've had in recent times, and perhaps, as one person said, perhaps ever. Well, nobody knows what happened back 100 years ago because nobody was there. You can't be there to take the flavor or see what's going on, and that's kind of hard to do. Now, there's something that everyone is missing, and they're missing it because they don't read the Bible. Nor do they understand God's laws by which he himself lives and by which everyone is subject to, whether they want to be or not. It is the most valuable lesson a person can learn. And we're going to talk about that lesson today with respect to us because I feel it's so important. I simply want to spend some time to discuss that in the context of what we have seen. Now, when I look at George Bush making his statements about the recent financial crisis and the latest results of the election, I do have to see an entirely different person than I saw at the beginning of his administration. What I saw, not so much in his announcement, he was rather upbeat, which I almost had to take that he was somewhat relieved. However, what I saw when he was trying to deal with the financial crisis was, let's say, an air of helplessness, even though there was an attempt at a bravado and a reassurance that somehow he and his administration could do something about it, but as it went on, you began to see that he was beginning to capitulate about everything, a number of things that he thought was right and good and about his administration. And how could something like this happen? I will characterize it this way. You can disagree with me or agree, but I begin to see what I would call a broken man. A man who was not so high on himself as he was at the beginning. What did we see at the beginning of his administration and up until before the financial crisis hit the world, especially with regard to his policies in Iraq and his policies on the war on terror? We saw a person and an administration that was right in their own eyes. It came across as very arrogant and self-willed, even prideful over who they were, and had taken the position and taken with their position that they had in the world. And as I said to you 2 weeks ago, the United States, up until this time, found themselves in the very enviable position before 2001, and even up until this financial crisis, as the undisputed leader of the world, financially, politically, militarily, with no one to oppose them. And now, as soon as this happens, you do find other nations beginning to rear their heads, namely Russia, who says, try and stop me, knowing the terrible situation that the United States was in. And people like Ahmadinejad of Iran, what are you going to do to me? Knowing that they can say things and do things and proceed with certain activities in their own country that the rest of the world supposedly is against, and say, well, what are you going to do? Well, so we find then a person in the most powerful position in the world, as it has been said, and in a nation that had the power and the ability to do whatever they wanted to do in the world, anywhere, anytime they had that, now not able to. And whatever they thought they could do, whatever they thought, whatever solutions they could bring, is now not possible. In such a short time, all that has come to an end, and they are seen this way more and more by the world, and Americans themselves are openly saying that George Bush is the worst president in modern times and probably ever, where at one point he was the rallying point. He was the one after 9/11 to stand up and say certain things about what was done to the United States. And everything has changed since then. Now, you know how he started out trying to solve the terrorist problems, perhaps with good intentions, but I listened to the statements made by George Bush and others of his administration at that time. I'm saying back at that time, when they were dealing with the concept of going into Iraq, or threatening to, dealing with the weapons of mass destruction. Remember the weapons of mass destruction that you haven't heard anything about for so long? Remember that? Okay, everybody remembers that. Now, I cringed, and my wife said the same thing. I heard statements by George Bush. I heard statements by Donald Rumsfeld. Remember him. Okay, and I cringed at these statements that were being made. And the tone of what we are going to do, because we have the power, because we have the will, because we have the ability to go anywhere in the world to do whatever we want to and to solve the problems. We can do this. And it became more about them and their might and their intellect and their cleverness and their ability than it was about actually solving the problem. And the way to solve the problem was to impose great military power over the world, command great influence over other nations, to become a part of it. So a strategy was developed, spurred on by, I would think, more than just an idea of seeking security for the homeland, but there was also that element that simply came through in the statements of arrogance and pride. And what then eventually emerged was, well, okay, what good did a lot of this do? Any more than to perhaps strategically place yourself in the world as having control over a certain part of the world that was always a problem, and now's the chance to deal with this, and to have even more power and influence than before. This is how it seemed to emerge. I mentioned Donald Rumsfeld, who seemed to know it all. You couldn't tell him a thing. You had this other person, what was his name, Wolfowitz, who eventually left the administration. And here were people who had certain ideas in their minds, and they all came together within that administration. And they knew better than everybody else, and they had certain things in their minds as to what they thought they could do. Now, I'm not one to place a lot of emphasis on body language, but at that time I went on to notice, and I saw that up until recently, how George Bush simply walked. And some of you nodding your heads, perhaps you noticed this. He walked out to a press conference. He walked out to the helicopter, you know, and there was this swagger. I call it a Texas swagger. Us folks from Louisiana have seen this before. All right. And we don't think a lot about it. I'll tell you that. But we see this. And you know, we're scratching. Now, you may not saw it. I don't know. Maybe you did. But I'm just telling you, this is what I saw. I said, it's getting worse, you know. Now I see something different. I see a person who's come down quite a bit. I would even go as far to characterize it that I see a broken man. His policies have not prevented the financial crisis. In fact, to some degree, with respect to the spending, especially on the war, it probably caused it. What seemed so right at the time of going into Iraq now does not seem so right. And we now have a reason for staying there. Do you know what it is? Well, we can't dishonor those who have died. This is the big thing. This is how it's being said. Now, totally different from the weapons of mass destruction. Then it moved on to toppling Saddam, you know, who was a vicious and a terrible ruler. All true. No question about that. You know, we could have done without that. And then it moved on to having a base now to operate from. And then one suspects if oil had something to do with it. But was there a greater underlying reason to use the greatest military strength in the world to go into a nation? Was it just to establish yourself in the Middle East and exercise control over a part of the world that was out of control of everyone else? Well, this seems to have emerged in time, because you look back, and hindsight is always much better in these cases, that you say, well, now, why didn't you not do anything in Iraq and let Iraq and Iran continue to fight it out? Now we've got Iran to deal with, where they could have at least neutralized each other. I don't know if that was thought of, but it would sit now. But once you get into that fight, now you've got to take care of both of them, which of course now you're not able to do, and one has taken advantage of a situation. There's something behind a lot of this that we've got to look at, and we're going to answer the question, what does that have to do with me and you? Let's go to 1 Chronicles chapter 21. 1 Chronicles 21. Here is the incident where, as it says, David numbered Israel. And we see a very important lesson here. But there's something behind this. Verse 1, 1 Chronicles 21. Now Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. Now Satan hates Israel. He hates the modern nations of Israel. And he'll do whatever he can. He'll get in wherever he can. So he stirred up the leader. Now God's king of all people. And he stirred him up. And David found out something, that he's still subject to some ways, if he's not careful, because of his own human nature. He's still going to be the king. Don't worry about that. God didn't remove him from that. But we find something that David had a weakness here, and he had something else in his mind. So David said to Joab and to the leaders of the people, go number Israel from Beersheba to Dan and bring the number of them to me that I may know it. And Joab answered. Listen to the answer of Joab. May the Lord make his people 100 times more than they are, but my Lord the king, are they not all my Lord's servants? Why then does my Lord require this thing? Why should he be a cause of guilt in Israel? What did Joab know? Why was he doing this? Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab. Therefore, Joab departed, went throughout all Israel, and came to Jerusalem. And Joab gave the sum of the number of the people to David, All Israel had 1,100,000 men who drew the sword, and Judah had 470,000 men who drew the sword. But he did not count Levi and Benjamin among them, for the king's word was abominable to Joab. Joab disagreed with it. He let the king know he disagreed with it. In the end, he carried it out. But you notice what the number was. Those who drew the sword. Why are you trying to figure out how big of an army you can muster? What are you doing? Why are you doing it? And God was displeased with this thing, and therefore he struck Israel. Now, David, you have to give him credit. He saw quickly what the problem was. He saw, I did something here that's not right. But it was more than that. A little bit more than that. So David said to God, I have sinned greatly because I have done this thing, but now I pray, take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly. And of course, Gad the seer, through whom God spoke, came and told him. He says, God's still going to do something here. He says, this is very, very, a very serious matter. Now, it says in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 16, a king shall not multiply horses to himself. For what reason? To go to war. What do you want to get number an army for? To go to war. What do you want to go to war for? Conquer more territory. What territory were you given to start with? What is yours? What did God give to you? And he said, here's what you do something with this. And what was he supposed to then defend? Not go out and conquer more territory, but deal with the security of his own nation, which he did in some ways, because you had some nations very close by, with the Philistines, the Ammonites, and so on, who would continually make forays in. They weren't going to give up, so, well, you had to deal with that. All right, but this is not what he's talking about here. What he's talking about is that he was going for one bridge too far. If I can take an old World War II movie title. He was going to go as far as he could go. He was going to gain more power now for himself. Well, for the kingdom, for Israel. Yeah, but for himself too. Sometimes people want to leave a legacy. The legacy was already there. God had already given him everything that he wanted. Now, this was not a Gentile empire. It was a nation of Israel. God said, I'm going to establish you among the nations. I'm not going to make an empire out of you. Later on, the Gentile empires came along that God predicted would come, because that's the way they would do things. And under the devil, those Gentile empires, which took over many nations, came about, including Israel. They took over Israel. God did not want Israel to do that. They were to be God's nation among many nations. And God was to be exalted among that nation and promoted because of what happened within that nation. And God's laws were to be laws of wisdom that other nations would look upon it. What do you want a big army for? What are you trying to do? How far do you want to go? Well, arrogance and pride will cause you, first of all, to make wrong decisions. It will cause you to make wrong decisions and cause you to have bad judgment. You will open yourself up to the temptation of Satan. You will not be able to see the pitfalls in your own ways, because you have something else so powerfully in your mind. And what would that be? What I can have? What I can be, who I am, pride, lust, vanity, and greed. Now, God has laws, and you're really not going to get around these laws. And God will, God doesn't want us to go beyond what is right and appropriate. I was very pleased with Sal's sermonette. He says, Lord, give me enough for myself. Not so that I will do something wrong and go out and steal or become a thief or gives me so much where I will be really high on myself and begin to forget you. I use that, by the way, I believe in the Bible study at the feast on God's financial system, because God has certain principles there by which he wants us to live. And that's a very, very important principle. So too here, that David was going too far in this, entirely too far in what he wanted to see. When David sinned with Bathsheba and had Uriah, her husband, killed, you know, God said, I would have given you what you wanted. He said, do you want more wives? I would have given to you. Please don't get me into a discussion on the morality of any of this. That's not the point. The point is that David took somebody else's wife. Why? Because he was king. The kings can do what they want to do. Nobody can question them. Nobody can say, you can't do this. And that's where David's sin was, more than anything else. This is where David's sin was, that he felt he had the right, he could do this. And that's the way Nathan formulated the story, if you recall. He says, here was this person who had all of this, and yet he went and took this other person's poor lamb. That's the way Nathan presented the story to him. It wasn't a matter of sexual immorality. It was a matter of him thinking who he was and what he could do and what he could be and what he could have because he was king. We have a serious problem here. I'm going to speak plain to you as your pastor who has the work of leading you into greener pastures. And we don't need to be staying in the bleak, dried up fields that we've been accustomed to picking through. And sometimes we stay there all the time because we're missing something in our own lives. The reason we get led away from the truth of God is because, number one reason, how we think about ourselves, our vanity, our pride, our arrogance that we display in what we say and do, all conspires to lead us away from God and begin to form our own ideas and our own truths that are truths to us. We think that we're smarter, we have more intellect than others. We're caught up in our own intellectual ability. And this is a combination for disaster. Let me just say, you can't come up with God's truth. Not a one of us did, not a one of us can. I don't care if you've been the most intelligent person in the world, you cannot come up with the truth of God, because the world has been blinded to it and has to be given by God. Now, anybody who goes off the rails thinks he can run better without the rails. Think about that one for a second. You ever see a train go off the rails? I have. How far does it get? Not very far. It's because there is a thought in his or her mind that he or she knows more than anybody else. Some people are caught up in the sound of their own voice, how well they can express themselves, how well they can formulate arguments, how clever they are, how much ability they have to do anything they want to do. Now, God has a way of dealing with this, and this is why no matter what the governments do or the nations do, it's not going to work in the end. God's going to let them try it. They can get the best people they can to solve the problem. I heard this. Obama has already got his people in, and I'm going to give him an A for trying. But the problem is so systemic in that he is, I don't care what you do, the whole thing has to be completely changed to a totally different basis, and they're going to try to solve the problem. You get the brightest and the best, as it were. Didn't Kevin Rudd say that? Let's get together the brightest and the best and come up with ideas. You guys remember this? What did he come up with? Anybody remember? There was a few little ideas floating around the edges of the Commonwealth as to what could possibly be done. And I listened to a few of them. I said, was that it? This is what the brightest and the best came of. Nothing was changing. Now, we read in Deuteronomy chapter 8, beginning with verse 10. Now, God knew something right in the very beginning. Deuteronomy 8 and verse 10. He says, now here's a pitfall when you go into the land. When you have eaten and are full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. Verse 11, beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, his statutes, which I command you this day, lest when you have eaten and are full and have built beautiful houses and to dwell in them, is he against this? Absolutely not. He wants you to have this. In fact, he set things up on this earth in such a way with the resources, both agriculture and the natural resources, a person can take those and use those and build enormous and wonderful things. So that's not what he's against. This is not the point here. And when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied. It just doesn't say added to. It says multiplied. When your heart is lifted up. Why does he say it that way? Does he mean it's inevitable that it's going to happen? I think perhaps he does. And you forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through that great and terrible wilderness in which were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do you good in the end. What end? When you come into the land, I don't want you to get into this attitude. And let me just say, because they were humbled for that time in the wilderness. And because they did experience hardships. They didn't have homes to live in. They had to be in tents. They were nomadic. They had so much less than other nations. And not only that, they were slaves. Prior to that, they were in bondage. This is what you were. I will say this, it slowed them down a whole lot. By the time they got into the land and they were given all of this, it's not that they didn't make mistakes, but he wanted them to remember where they came from so they wouldn't be so quick to do this. Now, did they eventually do this? Yes, they did. That's so unfortunate. I think that's a tendency of human nature, and God knows it's a tendency of human nature, terrible tendency, to get away from the humility that trials will bring you. The right kind of humility, good humility. And so he tests them. So to do you good in the end, then you say in your heart, so here's what you're going to say, my power and the might of my hand has gained me this wealth. And you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth. So it was completely within God's will for them to have wealth, isn't it? He's not against that. It's this, my power and the might of my hand has gained me this wealth. He says, and you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he swore to your fathers as it is this day. Who's this about? Is this not about you? This is about exalting God, promoting God and God's purpose. Then it shall be, if you by any means forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you this day that you shall surely perish. You know, why do we want to lay up for ourselves? Like I said, I appreciate that sermonette. Why do we want to lay up for ourselves? Security. why I'm going to get in such a position where nobody can take me down. I can't be hurt by any recession. I want to have my friends so that I can feel good about those who are around me. People get in cliques for the same reason. It's a sense of personal security. And there's this many ways in which we try to bunker ourselves, as it were, with riches, with people, and if a person's in power, to make sure they stay in power, so they get their friends in power, and they surround themselves with this. There's just a lot of things people do. Even the teenagers do this. They get people, you know, you're my friend. And so they get in gangs, or they get in groups, or they get in cliques, and that other person's on the outside, and there's a false sense of security. People do this. Now, our greatest enemy is our pride, is our vanity and the arrogance that it produces. Now, we've all gotten a bit more money recently. Why? What changed? I didn't change a thing. It all just sort of happened. Because of the prosperity that the world experienced, and we think that it was just going to go on. Now, I think we needed to be humbled. The whole world will be humbled to where they are willing to accept the rule of Christ. He won't make them do it. They have to be brought to this place where they have nothing left and that they will turn to Him. What is this passage telling us? If you analyze this passage and got the truths out of it, Deuteronomy chapter 8, 10 through 19, what would you get out of it? Number one, God knew they would do this. When they would get a bit of money in their pocket, they would become arrogant and haughty. That's what he says. They weren't used to it. How many times have we seen that? People not used to money, they get a bit of money. It changes them. People change. People win the lotto says, I'm not going to change. They change. Can't help it. It seems the way it is. Number two, he knew that when things went well for them, that is, they didn't have to struggle anymore, they would forget God and focus more on themselves. He knew that would happen. Number three, it will lead to eternal death. He says, you'll perish. It is a mortal sin in that sense, not in the Catholic way that I mean that, but it leads to death. What do I mean by that? Number four, it will lead you to idolatry and to other sins. When a person is proud and arrogant, they will think they have the prerogative to sin. God isn't in their minds. He isn't in the picture. Things are going well. There are no cautions anymore in the person's mind. They proceed without regard to consequences because they haven't experienced any for quite a while. Things are going well. Things are going well. My health is good. I got money in the bank. My super is looking really good. Not only that, every time I look in the mirror, I'm looking better. I hope that'll give you a little clue that things are not quite going the way you think it is. And the aches and pains that we tend to get as we go older, a little clue that things are not like you think they really are. No cautions, no conscience, and no regard for consequence. And the only way out of this, I want you to think about this one. The only way out of this is through trial, sometimes severe trial. Some sins can be repented of and forsaken. I'm going to submit to you that if you have developed this mindset, you will not change by your brother going to you. You will not change on this, that is a lack of humility or arrogance, because your pastor or your minister sees fit to counsel you on it. Or that you somehow will come to a personal realization that I am not as humble as I ought to be. Have you ever heard anybody say that? I've been in this business a long time. I have not heard anybody say, you know, I'm not as humble as I should be. If they did say it, I think I know what they would mean. That itself is a matter of vanity. Okay, I'm sorry to be so cynical. I'm just simply saying that this is something that a person just doesn't come to. You will not attribute your pride and your arrogance as the cause of God leaving you on your own. And when God leaves us on our own, sometimes we don't even know it. How did David sin? How did David come to number Israel? I mean, there was no outward sign as such. You're just fine. God left David alone. Let him sin. He left Hezekiah alone to see what he would do. And he saw what he would do, if you remember, because he skited about what he had in front of the ambassadors from Babylon. And Isaiah the prophet came and says, here's what you did. And as a result of that, you know what's going to happen? These are the people going to take you captive and your children captive and this city captive. You see, you can begin to have a certain frame of mind, a certain attitude, and it will lead you to making wrong decisions. That's a biggie. It will lead you to making wrong decisions. Now, this is why the Israelites had to be in bondage first. Then they had to be in deprivation next as they journeyed in the wilderness. Their blessings would not come easy. This is the way we want our blessings, isn't it? Just to come. Just send the blessings, Lord, if that's okay with you. God says, I don't think so. I don't want to hurt you. So when we get into an unteachable attitude, there is nothing God can do in the sense that that is simply bringing it to a person's attention. We can't be reached simply by being told. We have to go through a severe trial. And with angels, as we find in Ezekiel 28, verse 17, there is no redemption in this. Because this is the only sin, really, that they can be involved in. And this is at the very basis of it. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. Your heart was lifted up. It says you were, if you go back to the king of Tyre, it says your heart is lifted up because who you thought you were, your power and your strength that you had. Your heart is lifted up because of your riches, because of your splendor, because of your beauty. And then he goes on to say, because of your wisdom. Oh, yes. Satan allowed himself the conceit of pride. He began to know more than God. This is the danger. A person who knows so much more than anybody else, they can't see it. You know, this is why we have so many Church of God leaders today. Let's just speak plainly about it. As folks out there knows better than everybody else. It's not politically correct to say that, is it? Well, I don't particularly care. That is the problem. They know more. They know better. They are somebody's special person. And this is why a people also acquire different beliefs from what they knew was right. They know more. How does it start? It doesn't begin with a superior intellect. Sorry, I don't believe in that. It begins with thinking you have a superior intellect. A person can become very clever and begin to deceive themselves. The teachings of the church were humbly sought for. On the knees of a person, of one who came to understand how little he really knew. Go read the story. He had to come to understand how at one time he thought he knew it all. He knew better. He knew religion. He knew business, he knew advertising, he knew finances. Better than that, he knew people, important people. Read it, it's all there. And he found out he didn't really know anything. And there's one way to deal with that. You got to send the man down. He's got to experience failure. He's got to experience, he's got to be hit where it hurts. What he thinks of the most. And this happened to him. And God's not going to start showing people his truth until they understand who they're really going to be coming from. Everything he thought he was, how much ability he had, how much drive he had, how much reasoning power he had, how much logic he had, was nothing and did not produce the truth of God. It never will. Now, this is how the truths of God were forsaken later on. Somebody thought they knew better, and they began to get a certain opinion of themselves. And that's what led to it. There was a certain attitude, a certain frame of mind that was behind all of this that allowed a person then to just simply go against fact, to go against truth, to go against what they once knew. And if you're high on yourself, well then, yeah, that's inevitably the way it's going to go. Now, 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 1, 2 Corinthians 12, 1, here is what Paul confesses to anybody who wants to read it. 2 Corinthians 12, starting with verse 1. He says, "It is doubtless not profitable for me to boast. I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord." Now, he could have defended himself, which he attempted to do, I would think, in the most appropriate way, in 2 Corinthians, where he was being attacked. He says, "I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago, whether in the body I do not know, whether out of the body I do not know, God knows. Such a one was caught up into the third heaven. And I know a man, whether in the body or out of the body I do not know, God knows. He was caught up to paradise and heard inexpressible words, which is not lawful for a man to utter. Now of such a one I will boast, yet of myself I will not boast, except in my infirmities. For though I might desire to boast," that's quite an admission, isn't it? Of course you have a desire to say these things. Of course you do. We all do. That's a part of what we, the way we think. It's so natural to us. "But though I might desire to boast, I will not be a fool. For I will speak the truth, but I refrain lest anyone should think of me above what he sees me to be or hears from me." He didn't want this. He says, "I'll do anything to avoid this. I don't want you to think of me above what I am. Lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure." Similar to what David experienced when the devil influenced him to go and number Israel. What stirred that up? How much more I can be, how much more I can have. And he says, lest, he understood this purpose, "lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of revelations." There is only one way out. God was speaking to him. God was revealing to him truth. Why couldn't God simply reveal to him, "Saul, you'll have a tendency to get pretty high on yourself here. You know what God said?" God says, "I'm not even going to tell you that. Not even going to utter the words to you." He says, "I'm going to give you a thorn in the flesh." Oh, that's pretty tough. Why? There is no other way to deal with the lack of humility. Now concerning this thing, verse 8, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might depart from me. And he said, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. That's all it was said. That's all the answer he got. Therefore, I most gladly will I rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest on me. In other words, you know what he's saying? He says that, you know, I am just so blessed that God would do this to me, that I would not get out of hand in my own mind, in my own heart. And so that this is the only way that the power of Christ can be in him to do the work that God wanted him to do. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches and needs and persecutions and distresses. Now that, to me and you, is about the most strange and extreme attitude to have. You take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake, for when I am weak, then I am strong. You know what he's saying? He said the alternative is worse. That's what he's saying. The alternative is worse. If I succumb to this, where am I? I'll lose God altogether. He won't even be anywhere close to me. Christ knew there was no other way for Paul to stay humble and not be so high on himself because of the way God was using him. Romans chapter 12. Paul is clear in saying this. Romans 12, verse 3. For I say, through the grace given to me, you know, he didn't say, I say this because I was clever enough to think about it the other night. That's not what he says. I say, through the grace given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. For we have many members and only one body. I want to show you a better way. It says God resists the proud, James 4. God resists the proud. In verse 6, he gives more grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. All right, you get high on yourself, begin to think more of yourself in your own heart, which you probably don't recognize, and it's hard to see. Guess what? Doesn't matter whether you see it or not. God's not there. If you are humble, God is there. You drive God away. You attract God whenever you have a different frame of mind, whenever you have a constant, a continual, a present attitude than of knowing who you are and what you are. God is then in the picture. 2 Chronicles chapter 7, begin 13 through 15. 2 Chronicles 7, 13 through 15. God is answering Solomon here in the prayer that he prayed previously, and now there is a bit of text that elapses, and now he answers Solomon, and he answers him in this way. 2 Chronicles 7:13. When I shut up heaven and there is no rain, or command the locust to devour the land, or send pestilence among my people, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face. You think a humble person is going to seek God's face? Well, not if he's smart. If he sees himself as smart, why should he? He's smart. Doesn't have to. But if you see yourself as not so smart, He seeks my face, and they turn from their wicked ways. Then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land. Now my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to prayer made in this place. Let me make it about as clear as I can. Humility brings God into the picture, your picture. He brings, God is now present. God is now a part of your life with humility. Without humility, forget about having God around. He is not there. God resists the proud. So if we become self-sufficient in some way, we feel we don't need God. God says, I'll take you up on your word. God says, fine. And then try to have a go on your own. When God's blessings are withheld, I want to make this point clear. When God's blessings are withheld, it is not because of one sin. That's what we tend to think. Whenever we sin, we may think, or whenever we feel, you know, something goes wrong, we may think, well, what did I do? How many of you said that? I wonder what I did. Sure, that's what we say. That's not what God does. When God's blessings are withheld, and along with that, perhaps we are suffering trials, this is designed for one thing, not to stop you from stepping on the crack on the sidewalk. Does everybody understand what I mean by that? It's not because you sinned one time. That wasn't it. But for you to humble yourself, to come to a different frame of mind. You see, there's nothing more humbling than being shot down. Things don't work. Things go bad. You're suffering. You're hurting. There's pain. There's emotion. Maybe even physical pain. Let me be blunt. You're riding high. Can we do this? Sure we do this. It's natural. It's a part of our psyche. It's a part of our makeup. It's a part of what we do. And it's hard for us to get it. The nature of this sin is nobody can tell you. You're not wrong. You have to suffer in some way till you get the point that you aren't so great after all. The best teacher in the world can't explain this to you. I don't care what words they use. I don't care how good a counselor they are. They can't tell you this. The nature of this is that you're simply blinded to it. Now, when someone is caught in some other secret sin, sexual immorality, for instance, there's no mystery about that, some addiction, even a bad temper sometimes. I've told people all these things before. I've confronted them with some of these faults. And almost, they never deny it. They never deny it. Because they know, yeah, that's right, it's the way I am. Yeah, I do that. I got a pretty bad temper. Yep, that's right, I am. Yep, I'm back on the weed again. Yeah. Well, I mean, what are they going to say? Now, they may have a weakness that they don't immediately overcome it, but I have not had anybody in that regard, in these types of sins or failings, to tell me to mind my own business. I don't have a having one. If I've ever had to confront anybody, it's been, yep, that's right. And you might say, that sounds strange. I'm just telling you what I've found. With pride, when people are really high on themselves, no use talking. You're wasting your words. And if you try it, what does the book of Proverbs say? You have created an enemy. Quiet. Sorry. The Bible tells you, you can't correct a person like that. Now, God says some things about this. Well, he says in Proverbs 16, verse 18, for instance, just a couple of scriptures on this. Supports what I'm telling you. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Does it have to be that way? Yeah. Yeah, it does. Pride goes before destruction, haughty spirit before a fall. Verse 19, better to be of a humble spirit with the lowly than to divide the spoil with the proud. Why? Because the end of that person isn't going to be so good. Something's going to happen. Proverbs 18, verse 12. Before destruction, the heart of a man is haughty. And before honor is what? Humility. Does it have to be that way? Yes, it does. I'm sorry, but it does. That's just the nature of it. Now, well, what do we make of this sermon? If I can't tell you, then why am I telling you? I think we have enough to know how God works and what to look for. This is how it works. And if we're honest enough, we're led by God's Holy Spirit. It doesn't say we're immune. Hopefully, we'll be able to see what occurs. We see what happens, and we're quick. We're really quick then to say, wow, okay, so this is happening. I better take a look at some things. And this is something a person has to come to himself over. He really does, you know. And with God teaching him, God working with him. It's horrible to think that you're not humble. It is. It's a horrible thing. It's we can't even begin to consider it. You can talk to a person about other sins. Yep. Okay. They own up to it. That's it. This is different. Micah chapter 6 and verse 1. Hear now what the Lord says, Micah 6, verse 1 through 8. Arise, plead your case before the mountains, and let the hills hear your voice. Verse 2, Micah 6. O you mountains, the Lord's complaint. Hear, O you mountains, the Lord's complaint. And you strong foundations of the earth, for the Lord has a complaint against his people, and he will contend with Israel. O my people, what have I done to you? How have I wearied you? Testify against me. Come on, bring it forth. Let's go. Let's hear it. For I brought you up from the land of Egypt. I redeemed you from the house of bondage, and I sent you before Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. O my people, remember now what Balak, king of Moab, counseled, and what Balaam, the son of Beor, answered him from Acacia Grove to Gilgal, that you may know the righteousness of our Lord. And with what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with 1,000 rams, 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? People try to get around things, don't they? You know what God says? He says, he has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? You get outside of that, you're not with God. God's not with you, and you're not with God. Why do you walk humbly with God? What's the whole basis of this? Simply because you're teachable. Because you're teachable. It's not a matter of having a form of godliness, and that's what he was describing Israel had here. They had a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. You want the power of God. You want the presence of God. You want the strength of God to be in your life and to be a part of this. You want God then you certainly want the blessings of God. You want God to work behind the scenes for you. You want God to give you success in all things that you do. You got to walk humbly with God. Step outside of that, you're on your own. Now, this kind of attitude, then, is the basis of everything we do. Without it, we're going to get into all kinds of trouble. It's not a matter of being humble for a few minutes a day when you go before God. Now, we got to be careful, and I haven't heard anybody give the public prayers from here, Lord, we humbly beseech you. I'm going to give you a warning. Don't use those words. Okay? You already broke one rule when you did. You're letting him know you're humble. I think you ought to let God make that determination. At the same time, you don't do this once a day. The Jews might do it twice a day. The Muslims might do it five times a day. These are forms of worship. How devout, how pious. But do they walk humbly before God? Their every moment, their every thought is before God. Every word, every action that they have with other people is before God and shows a humility. And God says, what have I done? That's the question here. Yeah. What have I done? What's the problem here? Come on, bring it forth. You show me what I've done, that you can go off on your own. You can leave me behind. You can do this without me. Now, I'll tell you what he's done. Let's consider this for a moment. And we'll say this in conclusion. He created us in his own image. The greatest act of humility there ever was. Consider this now. He says, I am going to share my existence. I'm going to ultimately share my glory with other people. Nobody can question me as to who I am, my power. I am the creator. I know the end from the beginning. This is what he says. I want to share this. I want to give this to other people that he makes out of dirt. That is the greatest act of humility there ever was. Now, you might need to take that home and roll that around for a bit. But for God to even embark upon such a thing to where he's going to bring other people to where he is with freedom, total freedom, to be with him forever, to live with him forever, that's humility. The next greatest act of humility and service was, I think you're ahead of me on this one, aren't you? You know what? You know exactly what it is. The Creator himself came down, lived among those he created in a world they created, and he died for them on their own turf. Now, is this humility or what? I see humility in God. Now, it is true he is to be exalted. There's no question about it. It is true that we ought to be humbled before him. I mean, so humble. Before him and before everybody. But is this humility or what? Is this giving or what? Can you imagine Satan doing this? He wants contention with God. For what reason? Because he isn't the one who's the main person here, and he wants to be. He isn't the one who is to be worshipped, and he wants to be. I can't imagine Satan doing this. Can you imagine the great God sharing himself, his existence, his eternity with others in a close, intimate relationship, even those who have sinned against him, even those who have sinned against him and turned against him, sometimes not with the best attitude. Now, what right then do I have to deal unjustly toward anybody? What right? What right do I have to lift or promote myself? What right do I have to allow my self-importance to come into play when dealing with anybody? I don't have a right at all. Humbling yourself means a number of things. It means you will indeed seek God. Humbling yourself means you will not depart from God or his word. It will mean you will trust God at all times. It means that God will give you his grace, and you will receive everything you need to have through grace. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 7, in conclusion, here is, let's say, one of the most favorite scriptures there could ever could be, I suppose, in summing up things. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him. Not much of that is done these days. And he will direct your paths. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil. And it will be health to your flesh and strength to your bones. There's so much in here, brethren. It really is. It's a wonderful picture of the great God that we serve. And of course, what he wants from us too. Well, thank you very much for coming today.